This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of Washington Watch. Increasingly, Americans are concerned about the growing threat of terrorism, and for good reason. America is no longer immune or far removed from these acts designed to instill fear and terror in the hearts and minds of its victims. Now, these acts of terrorism are not random. They are not acts of workplace violence, as some would like us to believe. These acts are the results of a twisted and dangerous ideology found in a specific religion. Now, in light of the fact that the Obama administration refuses to acknowledge these threats emanating from radicalized Muslims, I think it's important for us to educate Americans about the ideology that we're dealing with. Now, the Family Research Council hosts several lectures throughout the year with the hope to inform, educate, and motivate. Well, in a recent lecture entitled ISIS, Sharia, and the Islamic State Phenomenon, the Caliphate in Light of Sharia, the founder of the Center for Islamic Research and Awareness, Al Fadi, spoke about the importance of knowing what we're dealing with when it comes to radical Islam. Who better to educate us than a convert from Islam to Christianity? Al Fadi's goal is to teach Christians how to properly dialogue with Muslims in order to share their faith in the most effective way. However, he is keenly aware of Sharia law, jihadists, and the effort to form a caliphate. So, on today's program, we listen to a recent lecture from the founder of the Center for Islamic Research and Awareness, Al Fadi.
Hello, everybody. I am excited to be here, and it is true that my passion is for ministry as well, reaching my Muslim people. But today what I'm going to be talking about is a part also that I feel is very important part of my ministry, and that's educating the public at large and educating policymakers and those who are involved basically with serious issues that we are facing these days, especially on the front lines. And the truth is, there is a side of Islam that we ought to know as well. And this is the part that I will be talking about today in order for us to be well-equipped, well-informed, and being able to make sound decisions in supporting policies or movements or whatever the case it might be. So bear with me. There is a lot of information that I'll be sharing with you today, and hopefully I'll be able to cover most of it. And towards the end, obviously, I will open it up for Q&A, so you'll get to ask any questions you like. And even after that, I'll be around for any personal interactions as well. As the general mentioned here, my ministry is called Sira International, and this is part of the training, basically, element that I do. And some of the things that I get involved with, just by simply coming from the Middle East, coming from a Muslim background, coming from Saudi, is dealing with the issue of Sharia. And you probably hear a lot today about Sharia. I mean, the topic used to be a foreign topic when I start talking about it maybe 10 years ago, but today it's everywhere. But the thing is, if you search the word Sharia, you're going to come across a lot of opinions about what Sharia is. What I'm going to share with you is really not just my own personal experience, but I'm going to share things with you from the sources of Sharia and why is it called Sharia, where does it come from, what does it teach, and obviously we wouldn't do it justice. I teach a whole course on Sharia that takes a whole semester, so you can imagine that I'll be sharing with you only the cream of the crop. And with that in mind, you know, these are the kind of questions that we typically ask. You know, what is Sharia? Is it Islamic? Is it not Islamic? You're going to hear, obviously, voices from moderate reformers who would like to tell you that Sharia law actually does not represent what ISIS does, for instance, that Islam doesn't teach the things that you are hearing about, and so on and so forth. But the truth of the matter is, oftentimes, Muslims who speak to these issues are ill-informed themselves. They rely on others in their own community, leaders, religious leaders in this matter. Sometimes maybe they themselves have never experienced Sharia because they never lived under so-called Sharia. In my case, I've been privileged, of course, to have lived in the Middle East, and I was born under Sharia. I lived under Sharia. And Iran is another example. It's the counterpart of where I grew up. I grew up under the Sunni form of that. Iran represents what is called the Shia form of basically Sharia. Now, here's other things that we need to, basically examine. Many times Muslims will tell you, really, that Sharia is essential for their beliefs. And I find this baffling, by the way, because a Muslim who practices Islam is already living under Sharia in terms of their personal relationship with God, sometimes even the relationship with their spouses, relationship with their own community. So the fact that Sharia is not a law in the books doesn't take away from the religion itself. In fact, I'm also baffled by the fact that you hear this rhetoric as if having no Sharia implemented here in the U.S., that means a Muslim community is deprived of its rights, religious rights in this case. I mean, we look at just at the Middle East, and only a handful of countries even allow portions of Sharia to be implemented as part of their constitutional law. Saudi Arabia is fully, basically, under Sharia. Iran is fully under Sharia. But from there, you begin to see portions that are incorporated with civic laws and man-made laws. So I find it appalling that there is this push for Sharia here when, in fact, it should be pushed back home, where the person usually comes from. And that tells me also that the person who's asking for it, this is from the Muslim community, obviously, they don't have a clue what Sharia is all about, and the fact that there is more freedom, for instance, to live under our constitution here in the U.S. or in Europe than to implement elements of Sharia, as I will show you also. So, what does the word Sharia mean? The word Sharia is an Arabic word, and what it means literally is the way. So, in other words, it's a way of life for a Muslim person. And, the origin of this word has to do with finding the way to water. And obviously, living in a desert, water is what gives you life. So this is where the word basically originated from, what it means. And the sources for Sharia are pretty simple. It's the Quran, that the word of God. Muslims believe that's what God revealed literally, basically, to the Prophet of Islam. And then the Sunnah, which is the biography of the Prophet and his own sayings, known as hadith, how the Prophet himself understood the Word of God, how he applied it as a model. And finally, we get to the third source, which is the one that is more prevalent today, and that's the scholarly interpretation of those teachings. You see, you'll be surprised to know that there are a lot of events and things that take place today in the Muslim world that you cannot find any precedent for it in the Quran or even how the Prophet handled similar things. Example, how do you deal with social media, Twitter, Facebook, and things like that? Well, you have to have an element of a judge or a scholar, Islamic scholar in this case, that must look at those things and interpret it in accordance to what he believes an equivalent issue that happened in the past history of Islam. And that's where the problem comes from in terms of the decisiveness that you're seeing in interpretations in the Middle East. Those that will tell you ISIS is not Islamic because what they do is really not taught by the Prophet, well, that might be true, that it wasn't taught by the Prophet that you burn the Jordanian pilot. But nevertheless, I can assure you, a judge with ISIS will give you a case study that they have done to basically support those kind of decisions as well. So we have to look at it from both sides. And not that I'm defending decisions like this. What I'm saying is you're going to encounter those difficulties and tensions in the Muslim world a lot. There is a reason why there is a tension within the countries themselves. You'll be surprised to know how many of the so-called ultra-conservatives in Saudi who are dissatisfied with the Saudi government, and they think it's not doing enough, basically, under Sharia. And when I hear this, I feel like, wow, if the Saudi government is not doing enough under Sharia, then what is the Sharia law that they're looking for? Because, to my knowledge, Saudi implements Sharia perfectly according to the prophetic way. Now, when we look at Sharia, Sharia is Islam, and Islam is Sharia. And that's why I was saying when you hear this rhetoric that if we do not have Sharia in our communities, in the U.S., in Europe, then we are being deprived of our religious freedom. That's not the case. Absolutely not, because simply a Muslim practicing his faith, going to the mosque, getting married under Sharia law, and raising his children according to Islam, all of that aspect is coming from Sharia. Now, I tell you what is missing, and I understand that there is a push to have the law in the books, because now you're missing things related, for instance, to what do you do when a father dies and he has a daughter and a son, inheritance issues. Obviously, our Constitution would not permit for the things that Sharia law would impose, like the daughter will get half of the portion automatically of what the son will get. Or the fact that the husband could marry up to four wives at the same time. Those are the kind of things, of course, that you're not going to get, obviously. Or if someone committed a crime, you're not going to go through the criminal court proceedings. Or his hand could be chopped off because he stole. I mean, this is the kind of things that we're seeing the push for, basically. You're not hearing that this is what's missing from our Sharia law. You're hearing that we're not getting Sharia law, and therefore we are deprived of our religious freedom. And I would beg the difference, basically, that that's not the case. Muslims are practicing Islam freely under the Constitution, whether in Europe, whether here, and they're actually getting more benefits than they would get normally under their own, basically, countries and their own governments and the law that is practiced back home. So here is just to summarize what I just shared. The Quran is the main source. Sunnah is the application of it. Judges is how they interpreted what the Prophet did, basically, or what the Quran shared. And when they come across certain areas that are vague, I'll share with you in a little bit about the process that they would go through. Now, here is examples from the Quran. The word Sharia actually is found in the Quran, and there's about maybe 80 occurrences in there that deal with that. But nevertheless, this is one of the prominent, basically, passages where you would come across the word itself. The first passage, basically, that comes from the Quran in chapter 45, verse 18, deals with God himself. Here, it's the Prophet himself applying that word to the Quran. Earlier in the same chapter, chapter 5, verses 42 to 47, he was actually, the Prophet of Islam, was referring to Christians and Jews to apply their own Sharia according to the Bible. So this is why there is a misunderstanding when a Muslim is raised, as I was raised, the thinking that Christianity is the law of the land in Europe and in the U.S., and their Sharia is based on the Bible. Therefore, if they hear of anything that is taking place in those areas, mass shootings, crimes, basically abductions, rape, so on and so forth, they would associate that immediately with the fact that because the Bible in their mind has been corrupted, then the Christian Sharia is not perfect anymore. And that's why there is the push for the perfect law now, which is the Sharia law, the Islamic law.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Glad to have you with us. We're taking a look back at what I consider to be one of our most important and educational lectures that we've had recently. It's titled ISIS, Sharia, and the Islamic State Phenomenon, the Caliphate in Light of Sharia. Don't go away. We'll hear more from Al Fadi right on the other side of this break. One of the questions I often receive from our listeners is, what can I do right here in my community to make a difference? The answer? A lot. And one of the most effective ways to make a difference right where you live is by organizing and leading a culture impact team in your church. A culture impact team, or CIT, will help keep the members of your church both informed and engaged through a wide variety of tools that we can place in your hands. Go to cultureimpact.org today for more information and order a Culture Impact Toolkit. We can provide you with all the training and materials you need to keep your church informed, inspired, and engaged. It's all free, and we can send it out to you today when you visit cultureimpact.org. Invite your friends at a church to join you in setting up a Culture Impact team. We want to help you answer the question, what can I do to make a difference? So visit cultureimpact.org or call us today toll-free 800-225-4008.
What does it mean to be equal? According to the dictionary, equal means the same for each person. Last year, the so-called Equality Act was introduced in Congress by adding sexual orientation and gender identity as protected categories under federal civil rights law. This act would give special perks to some people just because they identify as homosexual or transgender. It's important to remember that many bills introduced in Congress have positive-sounding titles that hide their true agendas. The Equality Act is a perfect example. This bill puts people who live out their faith on unequal footing under the law. It imposes sexual orientation and gender identity provisions on religious schools and universities, rejects the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and so much more. FRC's new publication on this legislation is a brief summary of the dangers this bill poses towards those who hold a biblical view of marriage and the family. Visit frc.org/equalityact to learn more.
The family is the heart of our economy. It is the greatest generator of knowledge, attitudes, skills, and habits of the individual, and is a generator of financial savings and capital. The vast majority of small businesses begin as family businesses, which eventually become the large businesses of the nation. Families are thus the great generators of business, and they are affected profoundly by the tax code. What Washington does to the family budget has a direct effect on the well-being of millions of moms, dads, and children. Given the importance of family economic well-being and the sluggishness of economic growth, Family Research Council proposes 5 short-term but productive actions that federal policymakers can take to help moms and dads better provide for their children through tax reform. To learn more about our family-friendly tax proposals, visit frc.org/taxes.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. Glad you're with us. This is, by the way, a special edition. We have a lecture series at the Family Research Council on a variety of topics. We have different experts come in and speak on a regular basis. Sometimes the topic is so good, the information we get is so good, I want to share it as widely as possible. And that's what this lecture is here today. This is Al Fadi. He was lecturing recently at the Family Research Council about radical Islam, Sharia law, and what's happening with ISIS. Now, keep in mind that Al Fadi is a convert from Islam to Christianity. So this is an insightful lecture. If you want to find out more, go to the website, tonyperkins.com, and you can follow the links over. But here's more of Al Fadi.
If you want to really look at Sharia law and say, so what does it cover? You'll be surprised to know that there are so many categories and so many ways to divide those categories. Now, in summary, I looked at a lot of them. In fact, there is one book called Reliance of the Travelers. I mean, that's based on a Shafi'i school of interpretation. It has almost like 9 or 10 different categories in it. But to summarize it, Sharia law really deals with Islamic rituals, how to pray, how to prepare yourself for prayer. In fact, it talks even which foot you should use to enter the mosque and which foot you should use to exit the mosque. I mean, it gets to those kind of details. And then you get to human behavior. How do you treat one another? How do you treat others in the community? How do you treat your family? The do's and don'ts, basically. The religious policing is based on this. The religious police that you hear about in Saudi, religious police that you hear about, for instance, modesty police and things like that in Iran. They're based on those kind of things. Then you get to crimes and punishment. And we're talking about things like adultery, highway robbery, which is basically almost like terrorism. That's what the word for it in Arabic. And then business contracts and relationship in the economical fashion. You'll be surprised to know that marriage under Sharia law is an economical, basically, deal. It's a contract between a man and a woman, and sometimes the family of the female is involved. There is payments, and that payment basically could be given to the father. And if there is a divorce, part of that payment could be returned back. So it is a business deal that is being incorporated. And then finally, Sharia talks about how to treat people of other faith. And that's where it gets a little bit, interesting. I grew up in Saudi, and I can tell you, until this day, that's true. Never in my life that I saw a single building called church. Nowhere you will find something like this. Because Sharia in its purest application basically prohibits this idea of permitting Christians to build churches. Now, Christians can keep what they have, for sure. Obviously, in Saudi, there isn't a single church to begin with, but let's assume it was there. You can keep that, but you cannot really modernize it, expand it, demolish it, and build a new one. In fact, you just look at the law in Egypt, and in Egypt, there's a lot of those laws that were incorporated that you can't even make a refurbishment of your own church without the government's approval. Where did this come from? Well, it came from the early days of Islam. The second caliph of Islam, his name is Umar, is the one who incorporated those kind of things. It's known as the Umar Pact. He made a pact basically with the people of the book, and part of those restrictions is things like this. So when it comes to Sharia, you are not permitted to practice your faith freely. But I find it awkward and ironic that when I came here, I practiced my faith very freely. Mosques were everywhere. I could talk about my religion, and I can even challenge people who were approaching me about Christ and Christianity. Yet you cannot do the exact same thing if you were to go back, for instance, to where I came from. This is where the issue that is never shared, of course, in the media. Just, put another word. Sharia deals with personal affairs, individual affairs, and his relationship maybe with family, corporal affairs, this individual and his relationship with his own community, legal affairs between all these parties, that includes marriage also, that includes selling and buying and so on and so forth, civic affairs in relationship basically to personal relations and corporal relations, and finally religious and spiritual affairs, relationship between Muslims and non-Muslims and relationship between the Muslim person and God. Here is what we get out of Sharia. Sharia really, for a Muslim person, means that Islam is superior to any other faith. That's pretty much the summary of that word. Because if you're not living under Sharia, then obviously you're not satisfied with the way you are practicing your faith. Otherwise, when you have Sharia, you are distinguished now from other faith communities. And the Quran makes it very clear, as I will show you in these verses and next verses, that Islam is the only acceptable religion. Right here, by virtue of this verse, by the way, you and I today, as non-Muslims, in the eyes of the God of Islam, are worthless. We mean nothing, basically. Because if Islam is the only acceptable religion, then what about other faith and other beliefs? Now, consider, for instance, what the Bible teaches. Jesus one time went to basically Samaria, and he invited people to accept his gospel. And when they refused, Philip said, "Should we pray and ask God to send fire from heaven?" And Jesus looked at him and said, "What kind of an odd request is this? Of course not. We are not going to force people to follow me." That's the contrast you're getting between how Christ shared and how Islam imposes. There is a reason why then we hear about ISIS going around. And I'm going to use ISIS a lot because, believe me, ISIS is the interpretation of what I'm sharing with you today. They go around and asking people, "You convert or you pay us or you'll be fought." I wonder where they got this idea from. Well, it's in the books of the Quran, of course, in the practice of Islam, in the history pages of the teaching of Islam. So ISIS, obviously, is trying to be faithful to the original teachings, and they're trying to reinvent the wheel by bringing the community of Islam back to its roots. Look at other examples in the Quran. You, the people of Islam, are the best peoples evolved to mankind. What about non-believers? Most vile of created beings.
You're listening to Washington Watch, a special lecture from the Family Research Council's lecture series. This one's ISIS, Sharia, and the Islamic State Phenomenon, the Caliphate in Light of Sharia. Now, don't go away because we're going to continue this on the other side of the break.
Every day, Christian values are being pushed out of the public square and out of public policy at an alarming rate. What can ordinary Christian citizens do to make their voices heard in an arena that is set on silencing them? FRC is here to help. Every week on the FRC blog, we will publish a question of the week that people like you are asking around the country, along with our answer. Send us a question you may have about how you can better live out your faith beyond the four walls of your church, or about any specific value that FRC continues to stand for, whether it be life, marriage and family, or religious liberty. Go to frc.org/contact and enter Question of the Week in the subject line for the chance to be published on our blog. Again, that's frc.org/contact and enter Question of the Week in the subject line. Thank you for standing with us.
What's at stake at this election? A lot. From the freedom to publicly practice and proclaim your faith, to the nomination of Supreme Court justices, matters of critical importance to Christians are looming in the days ahead. Family Research Council and FRC Action stand at the forefront of this battle. In these turbulent times, we trust in God's Word that He is for us and that He will give us a future and a hope of prosperity. That's why we invite you to join us on September 9th through 11th in Washington, D.C. for the Values Voter Summit. Come to learn, be encouraged, and meet others who will stand for the renewal of this great nation. You'll hear the latest on the threats to our nation's security, your religious freedom, the privacy and safety of our children and grandchildren, and much more. Visit valuesvotersummit.org for more information and to register. That's valuesvotersummit.org.
Welcome back to this special edition of Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. The website, tonyperkins.com. If you're on Twitter, you can keep up with us, at T. Perkins. All right, if you're just joining us, we're listening to a recent lecture at the Family Research Council by Al Fadi. Now, he is the founder of the Center for Islamic Research and Awareness. He is a convert from Islam to Christianity, and he's educating us on ISIS, Sharia, and the Islamic State phenomenon. Now, here's more from Al Fadi.
How to treat others outside of your Islamic community? You're merciful to one another in the Islamic community, ruthless to the unbelievers. Now, who do you think is the unbelievers here? That encompasses people of the book. That encompasses pagans. And it also encompasses Muslims who are called hypocritical, meaning they are not practicing their faith accurately. It is no wonder then that many of the Muslims are suffering in the hands of ISIS. It's no wonder that out of the 5 million that immigrated from Syria include majority of them to come from a Muslim background, because in the eyes of ISIS, for instance, you are not faithful to the religion itself, and therefore you cannot really claim to be followers of this faith. Now, when did Sharia develop? Now, we think that Sharia was developed basically right at the life of the Prophet's time and immediately after his death. But actually, Sharia as we know it today, it took about 300 years for it to evolve into what we know today as Sharia. In fact, it wasn't even codified as a law until the 19th century under the Ottoman Empire, being influenced by the Roman law as they were basically interacting with Europe and involved in that region. So there is basically this progression in developing Sharia. Add to that, of course, as Islam was expanding its territories, they were encountering more non-Arab people than Arabs, and therefore they had to really make some compromises and adapt to some of the laws of the lands that they are going to govern so that they can gain loyalty of the people. In addition to that, they have encountered new situations now that they have to come up with rules that deal with those particular situations. So this is how progressively Sharia has evolved. And right after the time of the Prophet, there is a period of caliphate known as the Righteous Dynasty. It took about 30 plus years. At the conclusion of that, in year 691-92, we have the majority Sunni dynasty known as the Umayyad. Now, during that time, the caliph was still the sole judge in making those decisions. So the head of the state still has that authority. Judges were already basically incorporated, but they didn't have that much clout to make any decision or to override until we get to the Abbasid dynasty, which really the long-lasting one that took about 500 plus years, known as the Golden Age, which is the dynasty that ISIS is trying to take Muslims back to. Because at that time, the judges became institutionalized, and there were various regions known as wilayat states, basically, and each basically region will have its own judge or group of judges. Departments were put in place. The caliph didn't really have the final say-so sometimes because the law of the land was based on the teaching of the Prophet and the teaching of the Quran. So this is where we find basically the model for Sharia. Right after that, of course, came two other Islamic dynasties or caliphate. But interestingly enough, that they lasted for about 700 years, one for about 200 years, known as the Mongol, and the last one is the Ottoman Empire. But Muslims who come from Arab background, they do not really appreciate those dynasties because they think like it should have been Arab dynasties, but it was taken away from them simply because they were not doing what God asked them to do faithfully, and as a result of that, it was stripped away from them. In fact, it is during the Mongol dynasty around the 12th, 13th century where we have a person by name Ibn Taymiyyah, who is the father of what ISIS does today. He is the head, basically, of ISIS's interpretation. He is the father of the school known as the Salafi school of interpretation, because he's the one who single-handedly took things all the way back to the beginning of Islam. And from there, he influenced people like bin Laden, who came 700 years after his time. This is basically why Sharia is important for us to understand. Because if you understand what Sharia teaches, you understand all of the elements that are taking place right now in the Middle East. It has been amplified in a way that is unbelievable, by the way. I mean, I would have talked about Sharia maybe 2 years ago, and maybe you wouldn't have been tracking with me about what I'm trying to share with you. But I assure you today, what you are watching and listening to will resonate with many of the things that I'm trying to share. And I'll tie this, of course, to ISIS and what ISIS is trying to do. Now, here's another problem the Muslim world has. Do you really interpret Sharia monolithically? Is there one decision for any crime or any relationship or any basically law? Of course not. And in the Sunni schools, four only survived. There was a lot, but four of them survived. And it started by one that was just moderate, and his teacher actually was more conservative than him. But then later came the Shafi'i, and they became more traditional. They followed the traditions, but at the same time leaving room for modernity, basically. And finally, the last person that evolved around the 10th century, 9th, 10th century, is the Hanbali school, from which basically the Saudi school is adhered to, Al-Qaeda school adhered to, Muslim Brotherhood adhered to, ISIS school adhered to. They're the ultra-conservative school. And notice, about 44% of the Muslim world. How many Muslims are we talking today in the world? About 1.5 billion Muslims in the world.
You've been listening to a recent lecture at the Family Research Council. This is a special edition of Washington Watch. This lecture was entitled ISIS, Sharia, and the Islamic State Phenomena, the Caliphate in Light of Sharia. Now don't go away, because on the other side of this break, we're going to have the conclusion from Al-Fadi when we return.
Are you feeling overwhelmed by the media telling you what to think? It is difficult to sort out what is true and what is false in the news. That's why Family Research Council President Tony Perkins writes a daily newsletter called The Washington Update. This daily email newsletter analyzes the most important events and topics at the forefront of the battles for religious liberty, the protection of life, and the defense of natural marriage, not only in Washington, but around the country. The Washington Update's daily articles cover a range of topics, from the latest election season news to underreported stories about both setbacks and successes in the fight for religious liberty, the sanctity of life, and marriage. Don't miss this critical, in-depth analysis of the day's most essential stories that are shaping our nation's future. Visit frc.org/Washington-update today to learn more and subscribe. Again, that's frc.org/Washington-update. As an attorney in communist Romania, Virginia Prodan searched for the truth. When she finally found it in the most forbidden book, the Bible, she made it her mission to defend fellow followers of Jesus Christ against unjust persecution. For this, Virginia was kidnapped, beaten, tortured, and placed under house arrest, even coming within seconds of being executed by order of Nicolae Ceaușescu, the Romanian dictator. Virginia Prodan's extraordinary courage, her search for truth, and her defiance in the face of evil is the subject of a riveting talk that she delivered at FRC's headquarters in Washington, D.C., marking the release of her memoir, Saving My Assassin. Visit frc.org/Romania to listen to her account, as well as the disturbing parallels she sees between attacks on religious liberty in Romania during the 1980s and what is happening in America today. That's frc.org/Romania. It's easy to get discouraged by the headlines. It can often feel as if God has left the building and we are on our own. As a response, Warren Cole Smith recently spoke at the Family Research Council about his book, Restoring All Things. In his soul-stirring presentation, Smith challenges the church to continue Christ's work of restoring all things by running toward the gunfire of cultural decline, to celebrate what is good, contribute what is missing, stop what is evil, and restore what is broken. Visit frc.org/university to view this talk and many more.
What's at stake at this election? A lot. From the freedom to publicly practice and proclaim your faith to the nomination of Supreme Court justices, matters of critical importance to Christians are looming in the days ahead. That's why we invite you to join us on September 9th through 11th in Washington, D.C. for the Values Voters Summit. Come to learn, be encouraged, and meet others who will stand for the renewal of this great nation. Visit valuesvotersummit.org for more information.
I'm Tony Perkins, and you are listening to Washington Watch. In fact, this is a special edition of Washington Watch. We've taken a break from our normal coverage of breaking news events to talk about, I think, a topic that's extremely important, obviously relevant. That is the issue of ISIS, Sharia, and the Islamic State phenomenon. Now, we have lectures at the Family Research Council all the time. We've been listening to it, if you're just joining us. This is a lecture recently held at the Family Research Council by Dr. Al Fadi, a convert from Islam to Christianity. So we're going to listen now to the conclusion of Dr. Al Fadi right now.
When it comes to the criminal law, crime and punishment, and Sharia law, there are three categories. Something called hudud. This is what God himself ordained in the Quran and says, this is a crime, and this is how it ought to be punished. Therefore, no one can change that. There is no negotiation. It covers things like adultery, drunkenness, highway robbery, which is like terrorism and causing mischief in the land. And then you have things like murder is not included in here, actually. Murder is included under a different category. Now, we move on to the other category called qisas, retaliation. Think of it as the law of retaliation, an eye for an eye, basically. Under this particular one, it's the issue of restitution. So if someone murdered another person, now the family of the deceased could ask for blood money, and therefore he will be forgiven. There is no punishment whatsoever that could be imposed upon that person. Other things related to basically, you know, lying and stealing money from somebody, even stealing sometimes, although it is under here, if there is a small portion, the person could return under some element of Sharia law, the person is given a chance for the first time to return what they stole. But major, basically, theft is covered under hudud. And finally, this is what we notice a lot, that judges do things and people will tell you that's not what Sharia teaches. Because the judge has something called tazir, or the liberty, basically, to he himself decide what would be the punishment for that particular crime or that particular, basically, incident. And it's pretty much up to the judge. That's what it means. But it's still not binding. No other judges have to follow it. And that's where we begin to see this tension that has taken place in the Middle East lately. Whether one group likes to follow this ruling, the other group doesn't like it and want to follow that ruling. For instance, Pakistan has a law in the books that says anything negative against the Prophet is a blasphemy and punishable by death. Well, people have been using it left and right these days. You can just go and accuse anybody of blaspheming against a prophet, and many innocent lives have either been punished by death or been thrown in jail. I mean, you just follow the news, just Google blasphemy against a prophet in Pakistan and see how many cases are mentioned, how many Christian people been accused of doing something like this. So this is why, you know, you go to Saudi. Saudi doesn't have something equivalent to that, but still it's a crime if you publicly make any announcement that is negative against a prophet. But nevertheless, there isn't a book a law in the books that tells you something like that. So there is obviously differences in how things are interpreted. Here's a quick look about where is Sharia law utilized and how strict it is. Very strict right here. Combination with civic law, more on the liberal side. And this is pretty much something you can find online. Now, a quick example of element of Sharia law as it applies to basically to these kind of areas. Freedom of speech. I mentioned, you know, that sometimes it's just punishable by death if you say anything negative against the prophet. What about the rights of LGBT? Well, in most countries, punishable by death. Women's right, very limited in marriage. For instance, a woman must marry one husband and he has to be a Muslim. A Muslim man, on the other hand, can marry up to four wives at the same time. And in some areas in Africa, they would say no. He can even add more and more if he want to, simply because of differences in how they interpret what the Quran says. But she cannot divorce her husband easily. It has to be approved by a judge. Oftentimes, these cases take years. There are cases in Saudi that take up to 7 to 10 years for the woman even just to get a divorce from a husband who hasn't really been taking care of her or the children. She has every right to ask for it. Sharia allows for it, but nevertheless, the court stalls those kind of things. And then restricted inheritance, as I mentioned, a woman under Sharia law will not have any leadership role. And personal freedom oftentimes is very lacking. Now let's look at a friend of mine who has a ministry known as the Center for Political Islam, allowed me kindly to share with you some of those charts that are available also freely on his website, the Center for Political Islam. If you were to study the Quran and look at the passages that deal with women, he discovered that 71% of the time when he looks at all the verses, and God bless his heart that he did the statistics for it, it's 71% of the time it's low status. 23% is equal. 5.3%, they have a high status. So what I mean is this. When you hear that Islam elevated the status of women, I'm not really so sure where exactly are we talking about. This 5% or 23%, what about the 71%? Now, look at it from the teaching of the Prophet himself. Almost 90% negative, 10% positive, and barely a 1% in high status. And this is the model, basically, for a Muslim person. This is where Sharia draws those kind of teachings from. Now, when it comes to freedom of religion, as I mentioned, there is different layers of hierarchy of how people ought to be treated under Sharia law. A Muslim is treated different than a Christian or a Jew, different than a non-religious person or someone who is a pagan, for instance. But even among the Muslims themselves, there is differences between those who are religious, follow Islam perfectly, and those who are moderate, that do not practice everything that Islam teaches. This is why many of the moderate reformers actually are at risk. Just like former Muslims like myself are at risk, the moderate Muslims are also at risk because they're speaking against the tide, against the traditions, against what Islam teaches. Just to give you another graphical illustration of what I mean, if you survey the treatment of infidels, that's the Arabic word for it, kafir, in the Quran and in the Sunnah, which is the hadith, the sayings of the Prophet, the biography and the life of the Prophet, you begin to see that the Quran invested a lot of its teachings, 64% dealing with the infidels in a negative way. Warning in here or fighting in here. And in the teaching of the Prophet, mainly it's fighting and wars and jihad against him, and the same thing in his sayings. And if you look at all of these elements, Quran, Sirah, Hadith, that's the trilogy, 60% is negative against the infidels. But this is where Sharia law draws, basically, its elements from. I think I have about probably 10 minutes or so. So I'm going to invest just the next 5 minutes to talk about just how does this tie to ISIS. Now, ISIS basically is trying to do exactly the same thing that you're seeing here. Islam started it right here in this small town called Mecca. For 23 years, by the time the Prophet died, he only have a small portion here followed by Islam. And then after his death, almost this area would have been covered under the banner of Islam. Then the first caliph came and extended all of this. And then the second caliph began to extend it to this portion, Egypt and Syria, and basically modern-day Turkey and Iraq. And from there, for 90 years, it went all the way to the southern, basically, parts of Spain. This is what ISIS is trying to resurrect today. This is the golden age that they're trying to go after. So the caliphate is important in terms of first defining the Islamic community that was lost, basically resurrected, retrieve it, redeem it, and then apply a unified Islamic law in all of this area. This is why ISIS is frustrated with Saudi or frustrated with Syria, Iraq, Egypt, and the list can go on and on and on, because in their mind, none of them is following the pure Sharia law as the Prophet himself and his companions have applied it. So that's why ISIS is kind of an important thing when it comes to that. Now, what are the different views on Sharia, on caliphate? Shia view that the caliphate started it only when their first Imam Ali became the caliph 30 years after the time of the Prophet of Islam. And he is the first out of the 12 imams. And I'll show you how that leads into what is happening today. And then the Sunni view will say, no, it was immediately after the death of a prophet, his father-in-law and his closest companion was the first. Then came Omar II, then Uthman, then Ali. So there is differences in opinions of how caliphate, Islamic State, is looked upon. In other words, which model do you follow if you want to implement it? This is the Iranian model. This is the Sunni model. No wonder then Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi renamed himself after this guy, because he wanted to take it back to the first Islamic caliph according to his own understanding. I'm going to show you this, and probably I'll close in the next couple of slides. There is always a movement, but there is always someone who nurtures this movement. I'm going to take it all the way to the life of the Prophet of Islam. He had his uncle who nurtured him, took care of him, protected him when he was under persecution as he declared himself to be a prophet. The result of this came a movement or a religion known as Islam. This religion influenced many scholars. One of those is the Hanbali, the one we said that he has the ultra-conservative school of Sharia. The Hanbali school influenced someone like Ibn Taymiyyah, who is a reformer of Islam that lived in the 12th, 13th centuries. Out of Ibn Taymiyyah's influence came the movement that is known as the Wahhabi, basically. And the Wahhabi movement was in the 19th century, which exists till this day. The Wahhabi movement, in alliance with the Muslim Brotherhood, influenced basically, originally, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, Hassan al-Banna, who also followed the same school, Hanbali. And then in alliance with them, they were nurtured for almost 30, 40 years in Saudi. From there, al-Banna and his movement influenced a radical Muslim Brotherhood known as Sayyid Qutb, who influenced bin Laden. Out of it came al-Qaeda. Bin Laden is the genesis for what we know today as ISIS. This is how things are connected to each other. They don't come out of void. No one just wakes up in the morning and say, yeah, I'm going to call myself Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi today, and I just like the name ISIS, and I'm going to just do it my way. No. There is a pattern that they're trying to follow, and they are frustrated with their own Muslim peers because they feel that they're not doing what they're supposed to do. And there comes the problem of silent majorities who are the enablers of this handful of the so-called radicals, which is, by the way, they are the fundamentalist, pure followers of Islam. You can call them the Islamic Puritans if you wish, because that's pretty much what they represent. And these are their sources: the Quran, the Hadith, the biography. Exactly the same thing that I shared with you. And I'm going to move on here and close with this. So why do the radicals get frustrated every now and then and have a movement, specifically since the 1970s, we've been seeing this Islamic awakening an Islamist movement, as it's called. Here is why. They believe Muslims in general have strayed away from the teaching of the Islam and the Prophet. There are a lot of hypocritical Muslims, they think. Also, they blame the West all the time for the loss of Islamic values, colonization, and they think also that the Crusades 1,000 years ago had something to do with this. 1,000 years ago, they still hold grudges against them. Then there is the community disunity. Why do we have borders? We should be without borders. This is the result of what the West has done to us. There is hatred towards the West. Then we have to follow the model of the Salaf, the early Islam, basically. There is corrupt Islamic leadership that is not following Sharia. There is call for liberation. In their mind, they are basically prisoners of their own states. And they want to liberate themselves from those kind of westernized civic laws because they perceive that they're persecuted as a result of their movement. And that's how they draw attention to their cause and propaganda and so on and so forth. And they attract a lot of followers. And finally, they look at movements like Shia, Ahmadiyya Muslim, basically Sufi Islam, Baha'i Islam, and even not-so-perfect Islamic communities as heretical Muslims who are not teaching the pure, teaching of Islam, the Prophet, and his followers. Finally, ISIS, just like Iran, they truly believe the establishment of Islamic caliphate is the sign of end times. This is what ISIS is doing. They're operating under that motive. And they believe they are bringing back the caliphate because the Prophet himself stated in one of his own sayings that at the end times, an Islamic caliphate will rise, will fight a lot of countries in the world. They will become victorious. Then Jesus will come back. And Islam become the law of the land, and that's how the end will come. Iran thinks exactly the same way, according to their own version of Islam. It's the 12th Imam that they are seeking to bring back. When he comes back, the end will start, basically. The clock will start ticking down, because he is going to usher the way for the coming of Christ, and his coming back will require a chaos in the region, fighting the enemies, basically, of Islam. And when that happens, the end will come. So you can see now how everything that we are dealing with is religious and spiritual at best. And hopefully, this explains then to us why there is this push at both sides to implement their own ideology, because they believe that they are the righteous ones, and they are the one who is going to be able to successfully bring this to conclusion.
You've been listening to a special edition of Washington Watch as we've been listening to a lecture by Al Fadi, the founder of the Center for Islamic Research and Awareness. Al Fadi is a convert from Islam to Christianity. If you'd like to know more, go to the website, tonyperkins.com, and you can follow the links over. Well, folks, great to have you with us today. I encourage you to tune in next time. Until then, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul, found in Ephesians 6, where it says, when you've done everything that you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you have taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit tonyperkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.